Beloved, you are now tuned in to Three Black Men, a podcast by three black men where we talk about theology, culture, and the world around us. The following content may not be suitable if you ain't real enough. Listener discretion is advised, because real recognize real. Here's the hope when we look familiar.
I come across a book by Hubert Brown, a black brother from the 1970s, writes this book called Black and Mennonite. And he makes this dope argument. Check this, hold your seats or something. He basically calls out white Mennonites and says, look, you've lost your Anabaptism, basically. And that the Black Power movement and Black theology actually have more to do with Anabaptists from the 16th century than you do, right? And he says, if you want to regain it, you can align yourself back on the margins among the oppressed and those who are struggling for justice and freedom, and you'll actually be closer than to the 16th century spirit. And so what he does is he dislodges this sense of ethnicity and sense of ownership, right? And gets back to the roots and the heart of what the Anabaptists were about in the 16th century. I mean, they were, you think about it, poor peasant rebellions.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the pod. My name is Robert.
I'm Sam.
And I'm Trey.
Hey, and we're the Three Black Men. And we have a special guest, and he's the first Black man.
Yes, the Four Black Men podcast
the first Black man guest on the pod, and it's the esteemed Dr. Drew Hart. Welcome to the pod.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm so hyped right now.
I'm excited and I'm honored to be the fourth Black man in this conversation right now. You know? That's what's up.
Exactly. So welcome. And I just want to say, thank you. It's interesting. You are a busy man and you are an author. You have two books out, Who Will Be a Witness in Trouble I've Seen. You're a professor. You also have a podcast and a whole network. You have a whole seminary that is kind of spawned off from this podcast network, and you are busy.
And that's only a portion of it.
You are a Renaissance man.
With the master plan, man. Yeah. I'm trying to get like you when I grow up.
Seriously.
Exactly. So thank you for being here. Thank you for blessing us with your time. Thank you.
I'm just complete honesty. I've just been looking forward to this conversation. And so obviously there are podcasts with Black men leading it, but thoughtful, dynamic conversations around faith that are engaging our Blackness and wrestling with what it means to be Black men in this world. Some of y'all I've been following on Twitter, we've been conversing back and forth. And so I've been looking forward to this a lot. Thanks for inviting me in.
Yo, this is about to be lit. I'm about to shed Rob's here right now, bro.
Yeah. So Dr. Hart, just tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, the things that are important to you right now in the season of your life before we jump into this conversation. You know, we could brag on you all day, but
and I'll just keep it coming.
Like, exactly, you know, right.
I believe, on a hard day, you know.
I believe in words of affirmation.
Basking it.
So tell us a little bit.
Yeah. So I'm the son of Tony and Carol. That's mom and dad. And born and raised, I originally from Norristown, Pennsylvania. I don't know if anybody knows the Philly area, but grew up in Norristown, lived there for 15 years. I got siblings, older sister, older brother, and a younger brother. Raised in the church. It was a non-denominational, but it was like Black Baptist, but undercover, right? Because they didn't call themselves Black Baptist. But in many ways, so much of who I am, I can point back to so much that was poured into me by that community. So I was half church boy, half, you know, around the way, you know, and in some ways my life has just kind of navigated that space. But let's see, what's important about me, you know, I'm a Pennsylvania boy. So I bounced from Philly to then I went to Messiah, at the time was Messiah College for my undergrad. And then I stayed in Harrisburg. I was a youth pastor in the city there at this multiracial church. This was like 05 to 08. And saw some of the underside of some of these multiracial churches, right? And that's that can be a whole nother podcast. But
yes.
But then
that's all.
And then came back to Philly, moved into West Oak Lane, East Germantown section of Philly, and did my MDiv. I was associate pastor at that time, ended up continuing on getting my PhD, which if you know me, that in and of itself was not, it was not the plan. I wasn't like the kid that was always getting straight A's, and it was just inevitable that I was going to get a PhD one day, only by the grace of God that that those doors opened up for me. And I should say that all throughout that time, since my undergrad, the question that came to me was wrestling with how in the world could Christianity be so entangled with racism? Like that was coming out of college. That was my question. And so I had been wrestling with it. So that's what my PhD was kind of grappling with, some of those stuff in more sophisticated ways. Got married in Philly to my wife, Renee. We now have three kids. Two of them are from Philly. One are from Harrisburg because we moved back to Harrisburg a second time. So now I call Harrisburg second home. I'm involved. So I'm assistant professor of theology at Messiah University. I'm also the program director for a program that we just launched called Thriving Together Congregations for Racial Justice. We're doing some race and place stuff with 12 congregations in our region, helping them refresh their sense of ministry and practice, and engage with the local histories of racism that have shaped our region. As you guys mentioned, I'm a podcaster. I co-host with Jared McKenna, who's from Australia. And so we got literally, it's a global conversation that we got going on, literally on the opposite side of the globe. And it's called Inverse Podcast. And we do run Subversive Seminary, Decolonizing Sunday School, and a few other things. And so there's a lot of cool folks, I'm sure folks that you all know that are connected to that community. And it's a life-giving space. It's been fun to just see what God has been doing in our community. Author and other stuff like that. But I'm just excited, for our conversation together.
My man said author and other stuff like that. Bro, when do you have time to eat?
What other stuff like that?
And so nonchalantly, some other stuff too. But
hosting a podcast with a brother from around from the other side of the planet, you know what I'm saying? Wrote a couple books in there, slight work, you know, something light, a little
Just a little light stuff. I'm like,
Worldwide conversations.
That's worldwide conversation.
I feel embarrassed. I feel like a scrub right now. I don't even want to have this
we're
conversation.
We're done here.
Cut that off, bro.
Cut this off.
Is this an interview to replace one of us?
One of you shall be replaced by this podcast. With that lead in, so it's interesting. So on the table today, we're going to be talking about embracing different theological traditions and political engagement, right? We're going to be ruminating together, engaging together. And it's interesting, you kind of gave the perfect lead in with that. And you have this interesting mix of backgrounds with how you grew up, and it's how you engage the world even now with global conversations and with how the faith tradition that you engage with now. And I want to frame this conversation with, we had a conversation in season one of this podcast entitled, Talking About Constructing different theological tables. And right. so it's interesting to have Dr. Hart here because you have the massive undertaking of constructing theological tables with all different kinds of people, whether it's in seminary or your podcast or your books. And so I want to just throw out this first question to you is, you're in this particular tradition now as an Anabaptist, and I want to ask, how did you arrive there? And from being a Baptist, and how did you get there? And what are some of the hurdles that you find in that tradition now?
Let me grab a notepad, because that is
do you
that,
feel me? Like,
yeah, that's a winding road.
It's an interesting, but it's actually been a really important part of my grappling. And in many ways, like, people don't, like, you can't make sense of the work that I do, my writings. It's so deeply embedded with the intersection of two streams, right?
Right.
And everything is wrestling with that tension. So my story, so I, as I mentioned, I went to Messiah College for undergrad. I chose it because, so like, my dad was a pastor and my grandfather was a church planter, right? I think, Trey, you know this.
Yeah, right.
So my grandfather was a well-known, like, preacher, evangelist. He would travel. A lot of people don't know. Tony Evans came up, like, Tony Evans got his call under my grandfather, right? So, like, my grandfather was out doing stuff, planting churches, multiple in the Philly area. So when I wanted to do undergrad, I was like, I don't want to be in the Philly area. I need, like, to get outside of this space because I need to be somewhere where my last name doesn't mean anything.
Mm.
You know? I just needed, and I wasn't, let's be honest, I wasn't that adventurous. So I wasn't going, like, to California. I just went 2 hours. I was like, there's this random Christian school 2 hours west. That's where I'm going. So okay. I mean, because I wanted to do biblical studies. I knew from very early on, like, that's where I was kind of focused. And so the biblical studies at Messiah, knew nothing about its traditions, background, whatever. But Messiah has, it was started by the Brethren in Christ, which was an offshoot of Mennonites. And so they're now, Messiah's not under that denomination, but they would talk about their Anabaptist, Pietist, Wesleyan roots, right? That's how Messiah talks about itself. So I go there for undergrad and get introduced to Anabaptism for the first time. Of course, I had never even heard of Anabaptism. I didn't even know the word, right? So I'm like, anti-Baptist? Like, what are y'all talking about, right? Wait a minute. I'm taking this person. Like, no,
it's not going to work. It's not going to work.
Right, it's not going to work. And I was like, all right, so not anti-Baptist, but Anabaptist. And you start learning about the tradition a little bit. I learned a little bit, but in no way did I become an Anabaptist while I was in college. I was wrestling with some of the questions. I mean, it was interesting, you know, in terms of some of the ways that I was being taught about it. But in many ways, I wasn't compelled by the tradition to, like, you know, become an Anabaptist in of itself, but I was exposed. But what happened immediately after that was there was a church in the city there, and this was the multiracial urban Anabaptist congregation that reached out to me.
That's a whole lot of adjectives there. Okay, we're going to talk about that one in a minute right there.
Right, because, well, in general, you don't think of, like, you think of Anabaptists as white, rural.
That's what I'm about to say. Those adjectives don't even flow together.
Right.
Like, usually you don't think of them as coming together.
Urban, multiracial Anabaptist. Okay,
yeah,
I heard that. I caught that. Go ahead.
So in that community, and it was a whole bunch of things. Like, I don't want to overstate because I'm suspicious of, you know, many multiracial, multicultural congregations and how they go about themselves. But that aside, there was also some really beautiful stuff happening in this community as well. And there was something compelling about it that, again, I would say I wouldn't have, if you had asked me, even though I became a youth pastor then, but if you had asked me, am I an Anabaptist? I'd say, no, I'm not an Anabaptist, but I can vibe with some of the Anabaptist emphases. That's what I would have said at that time, right? So, all right, all that happens. Then head back to Philly. And it's interesting that when I was back in my Black church circles, that all of a sudden I was like, you know, I've been formed kind of in a way that I don't think I was being honest about before. Like slowly, like some of this stuff has shaped who I was. And so the very first time I called myself Anabaptist was in Black church circles, because I wanted to just name the difference that I had recognized, that a lot of the folks that I was moving with, that there was some emphases that I had that I just wanted to kind of be honest about, right? Yeah. And then all of a sudden in Philly, like Philly is actually a quite, it's like a, it's one of the coolest Anabaptist spaces, because Philly, you got like third generation Black Mennonites. You got like Latino Mennonites. You got Indonesian. There's a, the largest Mennonite church in Philly is an Indonesian and a lot of like different immigrant groups and stuff. So like Philly's got, because it's so old in terms of like Mennonite history and stuff going back, there's interesting, cool stuff happening, but they're not doing the typical, like what you might think of as a stereotypical Anabaptist stuff. You know, like my friend Juan, he's got, you know, he's Puerto Rican in North Philly with a church that's like two thirds returning citizens, you know, and working there. It's just beautiful, right? You got up in the Northeast, a community, you know, doing cool CCDA community development stuff. You got folks doing sanctuary movement. Like this, it's a vibrant, engaged Anabaptist community, and it's multifaceted in its expressions. So I begin to connect with them while I'm in the Black church still. Associate pastor also then got another foot in this network, because there's a network. They work even across denominations. There's this urban Anabaptist network that exists in Philly, and they're collaborating. They're creating, like they had something called Kingdom Builders Construction Company, hiring returning citizens so that they would have work to do, right? And so just some collaborative projects.
Yo, that's so dope.
Teaching about mass incarceration, all that kind of stuff was going on. And so for me, like that was like the light bulb. So I had already started naming myself as an Anabaptist. And then I'm like, yeah, and this fits, like this made more sense, right? With then some of the other ways that people were living out what it meant to be Anabaptist. And what was really powerful for me is, so I started like, and this was during my dissertation, all stuff when I'm reading, I come across a book by Hubert Brown, a Black brother from the 1970s, writes this book called Black and Mennonite. And he makes this dope argument. Check this, hold your seats or something. He basically calls out white Mennonites and says, look, like you've lost your Anabaptism basically. And that the Black power movement and Black theology actually have more to do with Anabaptists from the 16th century than you do, right? And he says, if you want to regain it, you can align yourself back on the margins among the oppressed and those who are struggling for justice and freedom, and you'll actually be closer than to the 16th century spirit. And so what he does is he dislodges this sense of ethnicity and sense of ownership, right? And gets back to the roots and the heart of what the Anabaptists were about in the 16th century. I mean, they were, you think about it, poor peasant rebellions, and they were in the midst of that, right? I mean, and so it's just,
I'm sorry, what was his name again?
Hubert Brown.
And the name
Hubert Brown, and the book is called Black and Mennonites.
Black and Mennonites.
And so for a while, I was carrying, you know how they say like King was carrying Howard Thurman's Jesus and Disinherited around? Yeah, I started carrying that thing around with me. Because it just, it symbolized, you know, the kind of spirit of what I had been moving towards quite a bit. And so anyway, that was a part of my journey. And then when I started, because of connecting with them, I started connecting with the Mennonites more. So before it was a Brethren in Christ multi-year church, the Mennonites are actually, despite people's perception, they're number one, they're 20% non-white, the denomination. There's a significant Black Mennonite, you know, community all over the country in pockets in different areas. And they've been, I mean, you think about it, Vincent Harding, right? Friend of Dr. King, right? Yeah. Spent 10 years in the Mennonite church, right? You got folks like Hubert Brown and all these, Tony Brown. There's a whole bunch of folks. There's a community there. I did an endorsement, not an endorsement, I wrote the foreword for a new book that's coming out. Regina Shan Stoltz writes with Tobin Miller Shearer, but she's this Black Mennonite who teaches now, but she's been, her community goes back, you know, multiple generations, right? And so there's this tradition that exists as well. And they've always been able to draw from the Black church tradition. It's not a tradition that like erased the Black church. It drew the best of those traditions and also claimed its Anabaptism. So I felt like I had met a lot of kindred spirits in that way. Yeah, man.
Okay. So one quick question and then another follow-up after that. Do you currently like identify as a Mennonite? Like, are you?
I don't identify as Mennonite. It's funny when I go, so I have a Black Mennonite friend who jokes and teases me and she says, Drew, you're Menno famous. That's what she calls me.
Yeah.
Because the Mennonites like to call everything Menno something. That's what they do. But so I'll go in Mennonite spaces and speak. And I've spoken to like all their colleges and stuff like that. And they think I'm Mennonite because they see me around so much. And I have to tell them, nah, you can't claim me. I'm not a Mennonite. But
they be doing it.
I'm a friend of the Mennonites. That's how I always frame it.
Okay,
But I do claim that I'm an Anabaptist as a part of one of the, you know, ingredients of what makes me who I am. And so I consider Mennonites, many of them, conversation partners that have influenced me and vice versa.
I got you. Yeah, the Mennonites is out here recruiting and they got you in the brochures, dog. They was like, hey, man, Drew Hart. They claim me.
I literally have started out talks saying I'm not a Mennonite. Like, I started out, I'm like, y'all don't get to just claim folks, you know? But it's-
You might
it's,
be claim, bro.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Then, let's see your second question, bro.
And then the next one I had, and hopefully, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to dominate the discussion or nothing, but no, you mentioned that the Hubert Brown book, right? Black and Mennonites. And it reminded me of a tweet in a thread that I think maybe a couple of us was in one time where you talked about how you almost went the other way. Like, you ended up one way and who will be a witness is literally one of my favorite books that I've ever read.
You do love that book.
I really do. I'm just you can listen to these brothers. I was yeah. I'm sorry.
It did blow up our group chat for quite a while. Like, literally, yeah. Who will be a witness? Trey will be a witness.
Trey gonna be a witness.
Trey gonna be a witness.
But you know what? I actually just started it too. A couple weeks ago, and I'm gonna be a witness in a little bit.
I'm telling you.
I'm real witnessing a little bit.
Because Sam was working on some stuff and he was bouncing back and forth. I'm like, yo, you know what you need to check out? Matter of fact, I brought up specifically that chapter on Barabbas.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Liberating Barabbas. Oh my God.
Oh man,
that's the one for everybody.
Matter of fact, yep. We're gonna talk about that in a minute. Don't let me forget that. But back to
hold your mule, go.
Yeah, hold my mule. Because you talked about how you almost went the other way, and you mentioned another book that I actually love. Like, I have it on my bookshelf. Like, at one point I was determined it was gonna be one of the main sources in any dissertation I did, and you brought up Dr. Carl Ellis's Free at Last, and you referred to that as the Black Reform Bible, right? So I want to know, it's like, was there like, even just now you talked about when you was carrying around Black and Mennonites, was that before or after the or during the same time? Like, do you hold that intention? How do you view contributions such as those nowadays in your formation?
Yeah, I mean, so the Free at Last, someone gave that to me immediately after I graduated college. So yeah. I never swam in reform circles, but someone had, it was, when you're searching, I was searching. And so, you know, I mean, he was engaging, you know, Black folks, at least some of our questions.
For sure.
For me though, like I read that, but then a little bit after that, I read James Cone's God of the Oppressed. That was around the same time. And you can see where I went from there, you know, for me. Yeah. You know, I mean, I read God of the Oppressed every year.
Man,
I read God of the Oppressed every year.
I'm right? Like that with Free at Last now.
Yeah.
Since Trey put me into that.
Yeah. So for me, like I appreciated, you know, there's a guy that was influenced by Carl Ellis, Robert Gelinas. And he has a book called Finding the Groove. And it's kind of playing off of the idea of jazz theology that Carl Ellis teases out a little bit. And I really like what Gelinas does with it. He goes in a whole, it's beautiful what he does with it. But I don't know, at the end of the day, like, I mean, I don't want to say, Maybe it is. Maybe I will say, like, maybe Anabaptism and Reformed theology are probably incompatible with one another because they're two different ways of thinking about Christianity. And so I think, you know, the way that I was leaning around that combined with then Black liberation theology, you know, it couldn't work for me as a theological system, even if I could draw from particular things that I thought were helpful in terms of how he phrased things.
And with that, this is the perfect time to take a quick break. Stop, look, and listen, party people. I wanted to, on behalf of the three Black men, give you some ways that you can support your favorite three Black men. So, I wanted to say that, number one, you can like, rate, and review our podcast. So, all you have to do is go on, especially if you have Apple Podcast, just go ahead in the app, like, rate, and review. Okay? But only if you have something positive to say. But yeah, so when you like, rate, and review our podcast, it increases our visibility, and it helps us to be more credible. It helps us to gain sponsorships. So like, rate, and review. Number two, share this pod on social media. So especially when we drop trailers, go ahead, retweet that on Twitter. And yeah, go ahead and share. And lastly, you can support our Patreon. We'll have our Patreon link in the description of our podcast episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter. So those are a few ways that you can be active in helping to support us. And maybe you personally don't have a lot of money and you want to know, what are some ways that I can encourage and amplify these brothers' voices? So those are ways that you can practically engage with us, amplify our voices, and the conversations that we are trying to put out there in the world. Amen and amen.
The beauty and the ability to embrace theological traditions and the organic nature of, hey, I can appreciate the beauty of Mennonites without being Mennonite myself, and put different things and conversations with each other without even having to be from that tradition, right? And so I'm appreciating the beauty in hearing your story, right? And so part of what I'm hearing in what you're saying is, hey, I'm able to take the beauty from this tradition, from this book, from this thinker, from this author, and not incorporate every single thing I'm hearing, but grow in wisdom and knowledge without throwing everything out with it. And so in this age that is like hell bent on deconstructing, but never arriving at knowledge, anything and all, and just never arriving anywhere. I just am appreciating the beauty of what you're saying.
I appreciate that. Yeah. And you know, for me, like, so let's play with music, right? Sometimes the dissonance too, right? I mean, like there's some ways in which the traditions, there's some things more than what people might expect that fit well together. And then sometimes there's some dissonance there. And even in there, there's some beauty in the wisdom that can emerge in that dissonance that I think sometimes we like things a little too easy, a little too
clean cut. And we don't have to resolve it.
We don't have to resolve it. We don't have to have a simple, easy cookie cutter answer to everything. We can sit in the tension and in that sometimes we're seeing more than what we might think when everything feels nice and smooth.
And see that, like, that is hearing that, and Rob reminds me a lot, but here and Trader is too, but hearing that it's been difficult for me because I was sort of raised Baptist Pentecostal fundamentalist type, and then I went to Reformed, or well, then it went to sort of that Billy Graham evangelical, to then from it's right or wrong. There's no wrestle. There's right. no, like, you need to pick a side, right? Because who will you serve this? Right. You know what I'm saying? Right. There's always sort of been that pressure to know for sure and to choose. And I never felt like I had the liberty to wrestle with it. And it's crazy. I don't want to say unfortunately, but I think it's fortunate because my kids get to witness it. But I have a family now, and so I'm sort of wrestling with it. So we just left Reformed theology like December of last year. And so now we're finding ourselves where we're drawn back to the Black church, but then there's some things in some of the churches that we saw that we didn't necessarily like that are a little bit
My bad. I thought you was done with the thought.
So like we're wrestling with things, and we still we love scripture, we love God, we love Jesus, we love people, we love the idea of community that we get in the church. We just don't like what we're seeing from the church as it goes to community, and we're not planted in a place where we can really affect such change. And so like now we find like Trey, Rob, you know, these people are my community. We still watch stream services, like I watch Refuge and things like that, but we don't feel the pressure to feel like we need to necessarily know definitively everything of what we believe. We read right. scripture, we love God, we read books. And honestly, now I'm even comfortable to be like, I'll scroll through books and I'm like, well, what's this? Should I read it? Because, Reformed theology will teach you, you know, this is heresy. And, you know, stamp it as that. And so trepidation when it comes to reading books, like I don't want to touch it. You know, it's danger. And even some other spaces will do that too. Oh, you don't want to touch that. That's dangerous. And so now I'm like, you know what? I just read it. And if it's good, I'll take it. If it's not, whatever. I read a book and I learned something that someone else believes. Just hearing that and not feeling like I need to, be able to choose. When I first saw the hashtag Anablacktivism,
right?
Like hearing you speak, all of that really makes a lot more sense now. So,
I mean, because you think about like the logics of Reformed theology. I mean, it's deeply, deeply embedded in like a Western Enlightenment sensibilities, right? And so it takes the posture, I mean, we could say of God, right? Universal, all-knowing, certain clay, you know what I mean, in totality, right? And I mean, that's literally, I mean, this is where Black theology and Anabaptism, like they both were on the underside of that. They both mm-hmm. felt the implications of that mode of Christianity, right?
Yeah.
Coercive tyranny from the top down, but confident nonetheless, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. A sovereign God, right? That is like a tyrant and has no compassion for people. Right. Like, I mean, it's just, there are some dangers, I think, that, and so it's at those moments that I'm like, the conversations around deconstruction need to happen for some folks a little more than others, because some of this is dangerous. But as Robert was saying, like, you know, what are we going to embody, right? For every time you say no to something, you should be saying yes to something, right? And I think that we've lost sight. And so for me to learn from two streams and traditions that were born, that were emerged on the underside, right? That mm-hmm. have known the crucified Christ, in their own lived experience, and out of that wisdom and oral traditions have passed on from generation to generation a different kind of invitation to follow Jesus than what has been the mainstream dominant version. I mean, I think that those two are not the only streams, right? There are multiple streams that have been born on the underside, but I think that we have not given enough attention to, I mean, certainly I think people think about it in terms of the Black church. Unfortunately, the Anabaptist community, the loudest voices have domesticated that own tradition so that it no longer reflects, I think, a tradition from the underside among, you know, the celebrity Anabaptist, the white male show, right, that happens in the Anabaptist world. Mm-hmm. But there is a different on the margins Anabaptism that exists as well that still holds to something much more beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. That's dope. I think, like, we have brought up Reformed theology a couple of times, and one of the things that is so appealing about Reformed theology to so many people is this sense of scholarship and knowledge and this whole thing.
Systematizing it all.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Especially if you come from a tradition that is that is somewhat, I guess, fundamentalist in some certain senses, or it requires you or encourages you to elevate certain mythologies to actual like scientific fact and things like that. When you find out that there's this community of biblical scholars who can make all of these things and like you said, systematizing and put all of these wonderful words to things and everything is appealing, because now I get to engage my whole being and my intellect and things like that, which is why I think that a lot of the work that you are doing is important, right? Like, so I left my first seminary because it just wasn't for me. We ain't got to talk about that. But eventually when I went back, we will.
I'm just playing.
Stop that. You stop that right now. That's not in the contract. That is not in the contract. I declared, I was like, yo, if and when I go back to seminary, I'm going to an HBCU. And that's what I did. Because what I realized is that people don't get to tell me where scholarship exists, right? Like, there are scholars. Right. And I went among scholars who respected all of me and my history and some of the traditions that I've respected, as opposed to denigrating it and tossing it out. But the work that you're doing is so interesting, because like it is reclaiming the idea that scholarship exists only in this way, right? Like, who will be a witness? That book is thick as hell. Like, so many footnotes to all this stuff. Like, you know what you're talking about, bro. And all this stuff about system, like, okay, a systematic theology that does not allow for embodying and practicing in ways that somebody who doesn't also know that systematic theology can appreciate is no good to me, right? Like, if we have to leave it in the halls of academia, what good is that? And even like the name, because that is a very long subtitle on Who Will Be a Witness. I'm not even gonna try, but you are very direct about the fact that, no, okay, I want you to get this information and it ought to motivate you to do something. Like, you even talked to there at one point, you prepared to go to this rally and you had planned on going to jail. Like, you know, you marry your scholarship with action, and it's reclaiming all of the things that so many people appreciate about certain strains of the Black church. Even though, I'm gonna be all the way honest, sometimes we'd be lying about the Black church, because they wouldn't know, like, not everybody in the 60s was riding with Dr. King, but reclaiming the people who were, you know what I'm saying? And marrying that with a level of scholarship that appreciates the fact that, no, you don't, engaging God with all of your mind does not mean that I have to land here. So I appreciate the fact that you can still open all the books and do all your learning and preach and all of the halls of academia, all of that stuff, while still having your ear to the streets.
Yeah.
I think that's important, if I'm making sense, you know?
Can I also say, with that, I think the ear to the streets part, I think that's important to me too, because and almost to me, I respect you in that realm more, because yes, there are these credentials that you have earned, rightfully so, and I respect you for those credentials, but keeping your ear to the streets is so important to me, because you know, scholarship and these credentials, is one thing, but being relatable to our people and giving bread to everyday people who will never be able to see the inside of a classroom is why I respect you on a human level, right? Because for me, scholarship has to be able to be translated to everyday people, right? And so for me, I respect both ends of who you are, right? And that for me was the hard part of me choosing to go to school, right? Because, you know, as a Black man, I felt this tension of, do I want to be known in the halls of academia when I know many people will never have that privilege, right? And and will I be known for scholarship with being in rooms with people who will never, ever, ever, ever be in the streets with people who look like me ever, right? And so I echo what Trey said, both ends of what Trey said. I respect you on both fronts too. So I love that.
I appreciate that. And I mean, in some ways, like, you know, I've had to make a decision and continually make the same decision over and over again about why I do what I do. Because I mean, let's be honest, like among scholars, I get kind of side-eyed, right? Because I'm not writing books to other scholars. It does not look good. I'm telling you, it does not look good.
And I appreciate that, because books to other scholars are often whack, but sorry. Right.
But it's real though. Like there's a real pressure and I mean, people that for your term and tenure, they want you to do all, and so you got to make some decisions about like, why did you begin down this road to begin with, right? And for me, well, number one, even my first book, like For Trouble I've Seen, I always tell people that the story behind that is I was in my PhD program and Ferguson Uprising took off. I had just finished both of my, I finished my coursework. I had just finished my comprehensive exams and I had been locked away in, you know, the library while everything is going on, you know? And I decided like, I need to speak into what's happening right now. Cause that's actually the work that I was already doing prior to that. I wasn't like traveling like out of state, but I was in Philly and Harrisburg. That's the work that I was doing with churches. And so instead of working on my dissertation, I wrote Trouble I've Seen. I didn't tell my advisor, I didn't tell my committee. And I did, so if you look at the date of when Trouble I've Seen came out, it came out January 2016. I didn't graduate until the spring of 2016, right? And so the timing, I put my own dissertation on the back burner because I wanted to speak to everyday people about these issues that were going on. And so that's the kind of spirit that I've always had when it came to what kind of scholar I want to be. And the same thing with Who Will Be a Witness, that, you know, I want to talk about what I'm embodying and actually living out on the ground and invite people into this, right? In fact, a lot of it, so Who Will Be a Witness, I was speaking to congregations and folks are like, all right, sounds like at the end of the trouble scene, you want us to work on do justice, right? Well, what does that mean for a congregation? What does that look like, right? And I was like, all right, I've heard this enough. Well, I'm actually on the ground doing this stuff. I've got the theological education. I know the church history, how we got to this mess to begin with. I can put this all together and offer resources. And my goal, I always have the church that I was raised in as my first audience, right? Can they understand what I'm talking about? And if they can't understand what I'm talking about, then I don't want to write the book. That's not the kind of, I do write like short little academic essays and little things and I'll present a paper. But in terms of like really putting my heart and soul into something, it's that Black community that raised me is my first audience. That's why Who Will Be a Witness, when I talk about, you know, why I use the word deliverance rather than liberation, it's not because, I mean, I do use liberation still in the book as well, but I think about like, let's be honest, like that's not the language that church was raised in, but they did have a holistic way of understanding God's activity in a more comprehensive way. And it was the language of deliverance, right?
Wow.
It would use it. So I was like, that's the I'm speaking to my people the way that they taught me, right? So yeah, I'll throw liberation in there too, but I talk about God's deliverance because
that's the way they would understand it.
That's they're going to understand what I'm talking about in that way. And so I think like that has really oriented the work that I do. And then I think about all the other audiences and stuff as well. But that's my first audience always. Yeah.
Man,
that's dope.
I love that. I love that. And it takes intentionality. And that is hard when you have to make those continual decisions. And I face that regularly. And it is hard because it means you're giving up something.
Yep.
Respectability, credibility, and sometimes a bag.
Don't remind me.
I'm sorry. Sorry. There will be altar ministry over there. I want to throw this in here into our discussion, and feel free, brothers, to add in other things. But I want to throw political engagement into this discussion. We've kind of been dancing around it anyway, because we've been talking about theological traditions, but I see you talking about it when you, because one thing about Dr. Hart is he doesn't tweet all the time, but when he tweets, he just literally just no warm up, no, he just bam.
All in.
Literally just boom. I'm like, where did he
come from? Where was he? Just show up in the room, right?
Here, boom. I'm like, oh. Were you thinking about this all day? And then he just tweets it out, thread. I hate this. And then he just, all right, peace, y'all.
Yeah, argue with yourself.
Might drop on him.
Argue with your mama. Do not argue with him.
Right.
Get your uncle with them ashy elbows. Debate him. Like, oh, right, man.
And then he just leave. He's like, I'm not arguing with y'all. Peace. How does your understanding and the way that you engage God, the world, your particular understanding of God, deliverance, liberation, in the political arena, because one thing that I love about you is you don't seem ashamed of how to talk about politics. And I love that about you because, again, especially post 2016, a lot of people still seem to mince words when it comes to politics and if we should talk about politics. And would God want a Christian to talk about politics? You're like, argue with your mama, do not argue with me. And you don't go on tirades, but you do seem to understand that we live here. So thoughts?
I mean, there's so many different ways to enter into this conversation, but I mean, I was like, I'm a follower of Jesus. And so like, for me, like, how can I not be political, right? Jesus Ooh. Was political. The gospel is extremely political. And if you have any understanding of the New Testament and its context, then you understand how politically charged these first century Christians were, right? Gospel, euangelion, highly politically charged word that was used to talk about empires and emperors and this and that, and now is being applied to Jesus, right? Caesar is supposed to be savior, right? Deliverer, bringer of peace, and all these things applied to Jesus. Kingdom, right? You're not supposed to be any other king. I mean, it's just the whole thing is just politically. They chose all the politically charged words and applied it to Jesus. So when we begin to see like what they're doing, they're not shying away from the controversy of what it means to be followers of Jesus, and that sometimes we got to take some serious sides, right? And that's why I start off in the intro of Who Will Be Witness, like, look, there is no halvesies in Christianity. That's just not faithful. You can't go halvesies on serious social issues. When people are, there's disproportionate suffering, you can't meet in the middle on that, right? You know, no one says, you know, the most faithful way, you know, during the Holocaust with the moderates. No, of course not. Nobody would say that. But somehow we imagine that in our own contexts, that is somehow a kind of faithful expression of following Jesus, which means that something's off and diseased about our imagination for what it means to be followers of Jesus in the world. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that we've got to understand that following Jesus always take risks. Loving people requires taking risks and stepping out there. And so that's never been a problem for me. Again, because I'm so influenced by the Black prophetic stream of the Black church, as well as the radical discipleship wing of the Anabaptist movement, you know, for me, it's common sense, you know, that's it. And that it can't just be about what we say, though. We have to embody it. We have to live it out. I talk about, you know, what does it mean to make visible the story of Jesus on the ground in our own communities, right? Mm. For our neighbors to see. And if we can't manifest the reign of God where we're at in concrete, actual practice, then, you know, a lot of what we're saying is just, you know, talk.
Man, all right, no, okay. That just set off another light bulb for me, because another book I was talking to Sam about was Politics of Jesus by Aubrey Hendricks.
Yeah.
Not Aubrey Hendricks. And I was trying to figure out who was the recommender to me. I'm almost, was that one of the resources in Who Will Be a Witness? Did you put that in there? I'm only saying that because a lot of the stuff you were saying just now, mentioning the echoes, a lot of the stuff that he talks about in there, and the fact that, like, we can't divorce Jesus from, like, the political implications of the gospel of the New Testament, right? Like, he even drew the parallel between, like, the Gnostic heresy, where it only seemed like Jesus had a body, and how some people are, right, like, what he calls, I can't remember the exact term he used, but something to the effect of, like, political Gnostics, to the extent, like, oh no, it only seemed like Jesus was political, it only seemed like he cared about all of these things, and that we have to do a lot of mental gymnastics to get there. Yeah. And it's certainly been a process for me reclaiming those aspects of my belief and my life and reconciling them with my faith, because so many of us have been conditioned to believe that there is some sort of division between our faith and our politics, when at the same time we're being fed that idea, we're being fed the idea that neutral, or where we ought to be landed, is a lot of that stuff just happens to overlap with, like, conservative Republican politics, right? and reclaiming the fact that, okay, first of all, there's no such thing as, like, an apolitical faith. Like, faith is inherently, it's inherently political. It just is. Giving myself permission to, like, examine that and, like, look at the real life implications that are not devised from whatever systematic ideas we've had, but are in line with the things that, like, yo, Jesus was crucified. Like, right, he was executed. Like, he
state
was
sanctioned, like, execution under, exactly, Rome.
Under Rome, between two people who was like the man, you used all the fancy Greek words in there, all the stuff about the he was crucified, but between the insurrectionists, the thieves, all those people and everything like that. So, like, no, there's a lot of important stuff that if we pretend that all of this is apolitical, we're gonna miss the plot.
Yeah.
So the folks that say it's apolitical, I mean, those are the folks that are already in power, that are, it's just like smoke and mirrors to hide the fact that everything that they're doing is deeply political. And so they're trying to make it seem, they normalize and overwhelm you with their view to just take it as a norm. And then you don't actually question anything, but it's deeply political, right? I mean, that's the whole moral majority and all this stuff. They've been hoodwinking and bamboozling their folks for decades.
Ah, man, that's dope, Dr. Hart. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm trying to be respectful of your time, because I could literally do this all night. Like, this is such a fascinating... like, man, one day I'm gonna go get me one of them little PhD things. I'm gonna ask you to help me do it, bro. But again, thank you for your time. And before we go ahead and shut this down and tell the little lady to stop recording the conversation and everything like that, are there any parting words, anything that you would like to say to the people?
Any parting words? I don't know if I got any parting words, but
anything to plug? I mean, go get a book, his books, podcast.
Yeah, I mean, sure, you can do all that. But I will say this for real though. I do think that there's no way to faithfully follow Jesus in our world today unless we take seriously the legacy and the impact that colonialism has had on our world. And I think we have to say that explicitly, like you cannot follow Jesus faithfully unless you are decolonizing the entangled, mangled, diseased, distorted, domesticated Christianity that we've passed on for so long, right? Wow. And the only folks that will be of help in that are the very folks who are already and have been doing the work on the underside of that, right? Mm. Those are the rivers, the wells of wisdom, the nuggets of insights that we've got to draw from. And I think, you know, that's got to be the message that we're pushing everywhere all the time, because it is worse than we recognize. Wow. In terms of what we've done to Christianity in the West, in particular in the West. So anyway, that's not the most hopeful ending I know, but I'm such a discipleship to Jesus guy. That's the thing I want to pound all the time. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to follow Jesus? And how do we do it in light of the fact that Jesus has been whitened and domesticated and distorted and has been made into, you know, a mascot for the status quo. Like we've got to grapple with that. Anyway, that's my thing. But yes, you can certainly go buy Trouble I've Seen and Who Will Be a Witness and listen to Inverse Podcasts. And if you would like to check us out in terms of Subversive Seminary, there are some awesome folks in the community from not only US and Canada and Australia, but Kenya, South Africa, all over the place. And so we have a lot of fun. And so it would be fun to have some always open to some dope folks joining the community.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. You did bring it up. I was about to say you came from the Black church. This, you know the rule. You can take us to the low place, but then you got to take us to Calvary. You brought us.
And now stretched on.
Exactly.
Hug them high. And stretched them wide.
No, thank you so much.
Amen. Yeah, for real. Thank you so much.
Talked about a new segment. We're gonna talk about what's on the front burner, some things that we are excited about personally as individuals, and bringing that and sharing that with y'all.
Hey, party people. On this installment of On the Front Burner, I have poetry, and specifically I want to highlight Morgan Harper Nichols. And y'all, if you've been following me, you already know. I know everyone probably listening to this, maybe you've been a fan of Morgan's artwork, and maybe you followed her work on Instagram for a while. So I know I'm late to the party. But I have fallen in love with her poetry specifically, and I got her book, How Far You Have Come, Musings on Beauty and Courage, and whew, y'all, it is so good that I found myself slowing down and savoring each page because I did not want the book to end. And I don't know, something in this time in my life has really made me appreciate poetry more, and partially it is the world in the state that it is in, also getting into more poetry, also being connected to Trey and his love for poetry, and where all of these things have commingled, here I am. And so I love this book. I loved it so much that I purchased her other book, All Along You Were Blooming, Thoughts for a Boundless Living. And it is just so, I love it. I'm a stan. I would encourage you to get both of these and just sit with them. I've been sitting in the early morning hours or before I go to bed with these poems, and they've done my soul so much good. So, Morgan Harper Nichols, yeah, on the front burner.
We now have a Patreon, which I want to encourage each and every one of y'all to visit at patreon.com/threeblackmen. Think through it, pray through it, ask God if he would have you partake in this work that we're doing, because on top of some bonus content here, we have some blog pieces going up. There's going to be some devotional content coming out, and I want to encourage you guys to visit that Patreon, patreon.com/threeblackmen.
Go watch my kids ruin my videos.
Go ahead, watch them. Them babies ain't ruin nothing, man. Matter of fact, there's more people going to sign up to see them babies. How about that, bro?